This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Azif Hazuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
Welcome to the show that puts the news and the media in the spotlight. This week, we explore the extent of film censorship in Malaysia and the impact it has on the quality of films currently produced.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. IS-linked militants attack the Ismaili Muslim sect in Pakistan. And in Korea, an app helps bridge the language gap between the North and the South.
Ismailis are a tiny Muslim sect in Pakistan. Many of them run businesses and charities in Karachi. However, in May this year, they were brutally attacked by a group claiming to have links to the Islamic State. And a bomb blast killed around 45 men and women from the sect. This was the first time the sect was attacked. Naeem Sahotra visits the community to see how they are doing.
In 20-year-old Musarat Jahan's household, there is a sectarian harmony. She and her mother belong to Ismaili community, a subsect of Shia religious minority, while her father is Sunni.
He follows his sect and offer prayers according it, while my mother is a Shia who follows her own faith. I just respect them both and support them equally.
Around 300,000 Ismailis have lived in the Pakistan for decades.
We are a very peaceful community who largely help each other. We are not political people. We only follow what our Imam, Prince Aga Khan, asks us to follow. We follow our Imam to great extent that after the Prophet Muhammad and the Holy Quran, our Imam is the most important religious personality.
It's this belief that there is an important religious figure after the Prophet Muhammad that has angered extreme Sunni militants. Groups claiming to have links with the Islamic State killed 45 people in a mass shooting on a bus in May in Karachi. Ali Ahmed Jan lost his best friend in the attack. He says he was broke up to keep his faith secret.
Others just want to label us infidel. That's why we are specially told at home and at community level to avoid such discussion.
Ismailis are one of the most highly educated communities in Pakistan. They have 100% literacy rate across both girls and boys.
Our people strongly believe in giving education to the boys and girls. The community wants us to prosper and serve in important positions. No girl is married before completing at least 12 years of education.
Some of the country's best educational institutes and hospitals are run by Ismailis. I'm standing outside the Jamaat Khana, an Ismaili worship place on the outskirts of Karachi. It's a gate society, and dozens of the volunteers are guarding the prayer hall. In March, they have gathered to welcome New Year with celebration of the Nowruz. They soak blessing for the New Year. The children, youngers, and aged couple also dance. The community is very liberal. Nearby is the place where the militants brutally sold the victims on head. The attackers also left a message, warning the Ismailis to leave the country or face death. Thousands of Pakistani has been expressing solidarity with the Ismaili community. There have been protests on the street and online. Human rights activist Akhtar Balow says they were deeply shocked.
Just a surprising news, how they were targeted and why they were targeted. And their hospitals or educations, these institutions are not prohibited for other communities. They are working with the Ismaili communities, and for the betterment of Ismaili communities, they provide them shelter and health facilities. But simultaneously, they are providing these all facilities to each and every Pakistani.
Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has promised the community that the perpetrators of the massacre will be punished. 20-year-old Ali Ahmed Jan says the government should defeat terrorism through education.
We have very organized community with continuously conduct extra curriculum and religious event that keep young people away from violence. None of our community ever gets involved in terrorism.
For Asia Calling, this report produced by Naim Shahotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
Interesting thing about this is that a similar attack happened 2 months after this report. You know, 40 Ismailis were killed by IS militants on the bus. Even more curious were the pamphlets they left behind. My producer says I can't read it on air, so I'm just going to paraphrase. The IS militants state, get it, state that they will not stop until they have established their version of the Sharia state and cleanse the land of the infidels.
For those of you who can't see, our producer Sherika is shaking her head at dismay. Bad taste, Azif Azuddin. But you know, interfaith conflict still occurs today due to the lack of knowledge, understanding and acceptance. I mean, in this case, both parties practice Islam, but in different sects. I mean, it's a clear-cut case of who practices their religion better. One side has decided to determine that decision violently using guns and bombs. With the rise of the Islamic State now, I fear this is just going to get worse since nobody is safe now.
North Korea is sometimes seen as a country that's stuck in a time warp. And because it's so isolated, some South Koreans think that even the way the people there speak Korean is stuck in the past too. One thing is clear, for the 28,000 North Korean escapees who now live below the border, overcoming linguistic differences is one of their biggest challenges in resettling in the South. But some researchers are trying new ways to help close that language divide. Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
The North Korean accent is sometimes mocked on South Korean comedy programs. It sounds quaint or old-fashioned to some people here. Lee Song-ju says when he speaks on the phone, no one can tell he's a North Korean defector anymore. The 28-year-old says when he first arrived in South Korea back in 2002, his accent embarrassed him.
I had a really strong North Korean accent. People just keep asking me about my hometown, my background. So whenever I was asked by them, I had to say lie.
Why were you ashamed?
Man, because I don't want to share my story. People know that North Korea is really poor country.
He says South Koreans would have looked down on him and he wouldn't have made any friends, so he picked up the local accent pretty fast. Accent assimilation is one way defectors try to fit in here, says Sokil Park, Director of Research and Strategy at the refugee support group Liberty in North Korea. But he says the biggest linguistic challenge for newly arrived defectors is learning all the new words that South Korea has acquired during the past 7 decades since the peninsula was split.
There's been a lot of linguistic change, particularly in the South, with the influence of globalization and the English language in particular. So they arrive here often are surprised with the amount of borrowed words that they're unfamiliar with as soon as they go into a coffee shop, for instance.
For North Korean defectors struggling with South Korea-only words and expressions, a new smartphone app could help bridge the language gap. It's called Univoca, short for Unification Vocabulary. It allows a user to type in or snap a photo of an unknown word, and it gives a North Korean translation. There is also a section that gives practical language advice, like how to order a pizza, and there's also a video explaining some useful dating terminology. One of the app's developers, Jang Jong-chol of the advertising firm Cheo Worldwide, explains how they decided on the vocabulary. He flips through a book with highlighted words on some pages.
We first showed this typical South Korean grammar textbook to a class of teenage defectors who picked out the unfamiliar words. We also consulted older North Korean to help with translations. So far, they have added about 3,600 words to the app's database.
Zhang adds, before he started working on the app, he never realized how limited North Korean vocabulary is or how some expressions, now out of style in the South, are still used in the North. I want to get a North Korean's opinion about this translation app, so I ask Lee Song-ju to install it on his phone. We take a walk around a shopping plaza below the Sea Tower, the Koreanized way of saying tower, which seems like a good word to start off with.
So now I'm typing in, okay, in the app. Let's say tower. There's no translation for tower.
We pass an ice cream shop.
Yes, ice cream. They said 얼음 보숭이 in North Korean, but we don't use this word when I was in North Korea. We just say ice cream and ice cakey. Oh, really? Yeah.
One more try. We find a Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, donuts. Oh, here we go. Oh, yes. This is correct. We're using, in North Korean, it is 가락지빵.
Ring bread.
Yeah, ring bread, yes. But we call 가락지빵 or donuts.
So, based on this quick test, the app's vocab list seems somewhat hit or miss. Maybe its developers could get some help from Han Young-un. He's a South Korean lexicographer who, for the past several years, has worked with his North Korean counterparts to assemble the first unified Korean dictionary. And from what he's learned, he says he doesn't believe that the North Korean language is stuck in the past.
All languages are living and growing, even North Korea. Over the years, they borrowed foreign words too, but mainly from Russian and Chinese.
Political tensions have gotten in the way of completing the joint dictionary, but Han hopes the project will be wrapped up in a few more years. As for the Univoca North Korean language app, it's open source, so users can add new words as they come across them. Defector Lee Song-ju says he was skeptical at first, but the app won him over.
This is really nice. I mean, pretty good, yeah. So it was very well designed. There are not many functions, but all is very useful for working escapees who just arrived here.
Inside a supermarket, Lee tests out the app on a few more South Korea-only words, including the one for restroom.
화장실.
You don't call that in North Korea?
We have different words.
He types in 화장실, and a translation appears.
화장실
in
Korean.
Oh, this is a good 위생실 in North Korean.
Oh, yeah. Okay, awesome.
For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Language is one of the first things we pick up when we go to a new place, which makes it easier for us to assimilate into a new society. I mean, sometimes we pick up and emulate accents or speech patterns so that we can blend in better. It makes an outsider or foreigner seem more approachable, right? I mean, even in Malaysia, if I go to Penang or Kelantan, the Kajang girl in me gets confused with their different accents and the way they say certain words when I know they're speaking Malay.
Mukchek Kelate, Aisha.
Whatever, as if.
Okay, learning a language or emulating accents isn't easy. You know, it's something you pick up better at a younger age. Though in the later years, picking it up has a lot to do with interest, be it a hobby or a concert or a band you really like. You know, for me though, I find it really interesting that a lot of people, myself included, spend a few weeks or years overseas, pick up the local accent and coming back losing the original native accent. How does that happen, I wonder? Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. And after the break, we explore film censorship in Malaysia and how this impacts the quality of films currently produced.
Here's Hassan Muthalib, a film historian.
Well, in the first place, I would like to applaud Irma Fatima for standing her ground. It's high time somebody did something like this because too much interference has been going on with the film industry. And the industry is already plagued with a lot of problems. And this is adding to it, and many people are losing their money because their films get banned, get censored, and all kinds of funny things that are going on. So we do not know exactly what is going on in this country.
I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
You're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And The Week in Review continues.
Act 1.
Last week, local film director Irma Fatimah decided to pull her movie Pesan Dari Tuhan off TV3's Cerika Ahad segment. The movie tells a story about a power struggle within a family over inheritance until the village they lived in was devastated by floods. It's very different from what local cinema is used to. Usually you have movies that ride on themes of love or action. Irma was told to make between 30 and 40 cuts. And according to regulators, these parts were politically insensitive.
Pemimpin seperti inilah yang akan membela nasib anda semua dengan pembaharuan yang dibawa di dalam kepimpinannya.
Inilah orang kata bini ketua kampung. Bolehlah saya melarang dengan benda ni. Tak adalah saya malu sangat nak jalan sebelah awak nanti.
When Irma pulled the movie off TV3, it caused a social media uproar. Users debated some of the reasons given by Lembaga Penapisan Film or the Film Censorship Board that demanded the edits. The chairman of the LPF, Dato' Abdul Halim Hamid, claims he hasn't watched the disputed film and an official application on the edits was not submitted to him.
Saya tak komen, saya tak tengok filem tu macam mana. Dia sebenarnya saya dapat maklumat daripada ahli LPF di Media Prima. Media Prima bagi pada LPF secara untuk buat preview. So yeah, and then probably there's some comment lah from ahli panel di Media Prima sana, TV3. But then Media Prima tidak secara official lah submit filem tu untuk ditapis. There is no report lah. Because dia punya laporan tapisan filem di sana, bila dia masuk report, kita akan lulus di pejabat di sini. It's not apa officially being censored. Cuma diminta preview lah secara macam tu. But saya pun tak tahu apa berapa banyak potongan, apa scene yang potong tu.
Halim believes his officers suggested the edits to Irma during the preview before it was due for public screening. So what's the actual process for a film to go to the editing knife?
Ahli LPF ditempatkan, ditumpangkan di bangunan sana. Then dia buat tapisan di sana. And then the film tu, the report will come to us in Putrajaya. Then we give the approval. Bila kita approval tu, maknanya baru filem tu boleh ditayangkan di TV. Maknanya it doesn't come to me. Maknanya dia orang tidak buat secara formal lah, buat censorship. Agaknya dia minta komen ke feedback ke daripada dia orang tu. Kalau benda tu dia tak berhati apa, dia boleh datang bincang dengan saya. Kalau filem-filem yang nak tayangkan kat panggung kan, dia orang kan tengok first round bila dia, bila kita keluar laporan. Kalau dia punya penerbit tak berhati, dia datang jumpa dengan saya, nak buat rayuan apa semua. And then saya tonton filem tu, mungkin kadang saya pertimbangkan. Dia orang tak setuju. Keputusan LPF, dia boleh bawa kepada lembaga jawatan kuasa rayuan filem, JKRF. Maknanya, it is a Media Prima decision lah not to submit kepada LPF untuk buat tapisan secara rasmi. Mana masuklah kita punya sistem, kan? Kita akan buat tapisan, kita akan buat laporan. Laporan tu will come to me.
We need to make it clear that Irma chose to pull her film from TV3 on her own terms because she did not agree to the cuts. The Film Censorship Board insists that Pesan Dari Tuhan is not banned and that the movie producers should discuss the matter with the chairman first before pulling the film out entirely.
Ya, dia berfikir it's not banned kan, kita pun tak ada potong jarim. Kalau dia kalau benda biasa-biasa macam ni, kalau penerbit filem kan, biasanya dia will come, kalau ada issue, dia will come and discuss with me. Kadang-kadang dia akan bawa, akan buat DVD, dia minta saya, kita preview. And then kita preview, kita bagi, then kita panggil dia, kita bincang balik. Kita bagi tahu lah, kalau filem ni, kalau kita akan luluskan, macam ni, mungkin ada potongan, ha? Mungkin kita berikan sketsa 18 ke atau 13. Saya rasa filem-filem Melayu ni biasa sangat kita potong. Very common. Censorship ni memang ada kan.
Hassan Muttalib, a film historian, has been in the film scene for over half a century. In 1998, Hassan created Silat Legenda, Malaysia's first full-length animated movie. In 2013, he published Malaysian Cinema in a Bottle, a chronicle of a century-long history of Malaysian cinema. Here's his thoughts on Irma's predicament.
Well, in the first place, I would like to applaud Irma Fatimah for standing her ground. It's high time somebody did something like this, because too much interference has been going on with the film industry. And the industry is already plagued with a lot of problems, and this is adding to it, and many people are losing their money because their films get banned, get censored, and all kinds of funny things that are going on. So we do not know exactly what is going on in this country.
So what would drive the Film Censorship Board to make that many edits or even ban a film?
Well, I think it's not the censor board. It's the people above them. For instance, there were films that were already passed by the censor board. And suddenly, one person speaks up in the newspaper, and then these people come into the picture, and they interview five people who had not seen the film. And I'm talking about Lelaki Komunis Terakhir, which was passed by the censor board. But then they interviewed five people and gave them a leading question. Should such a film be made? Because it was supposed to be about, the title is The Last Communist, but there were absolutely no communists shown in the film. Now, the other one is The New Village, which was passed, and then again, these people came into the picture, and then it got banned on the pretext that it was promoting a wrong version of the history. I would like to question, who is actually subverting our history now?
Are films critical of the government more likely to be banned or have more edits demanded? Erma Fatima's movie allegedly contains scenes that do not portray the government favourably. Hassan himself is perplexed.
Well, I'm wondering, why do they want to ban that when it is already open? They are openly asking people to vote for them, which is already very wrong. So if it is happening, why is it that we cannot show it? For instance, like Jalan Pintas, directed by Namrud, they wanted to do 18 cuts, and he refused. So the film doesn't go on air, and the producer loses money. So I cannot understand why they are so sensitive. But then if you look at the current political situation, it looks like they are very paranoid now.
Has censorship always been this stringent? When we look back at the era of P. Ramlee, it seems as if political censorship was not as strict.
Jikalau ayahanda mati, segala harta-hartanya terpulang kepada siapa?
Pada kekanda lah, kerana kekanda saudara tua.
Semua?
Habis?
Itu tidak adil. Itu namanya diktator. Kanda, Adinda rasa lebih baik kita bahagikan harta-harta ini secara demokrasi.
Bagaimana? Begini,
Kanda yang lebih tua, Kanda mesti mengalah. Kanda akan mati dulu, Adinda akan tanam Kanda. Kanda jangan ambil satu sen pun harta ayahanda. Dermakan semuanya pada Adinda bulat-bulat. Itu demokrasi.
Demokrasi apa?
Demokrasi terpimpin.
Terpimpin kepala kota kau.
Now, in the 1950s, the head of the censorship board was an Englishman. And the Shaw Brothers and Cathy Crisp, they had in their contract that there was going to be no criticism of the British. Otherwise, definitely the film would have been banned. Now, today we are in control. So why are we banning our own films? So it's no better than the 1950s, isn't it?
Act 3.
Given the social climate now, when people are more vocal about their discontent, to what extent have Malay films gone towards political and social critique?
Many Malay filmmakers in the last few years have been very, very critical, but they do it very obliquely. For instance, Mamat Khalid's films have a lot of political comment and criticism against the establishment. And of course, Namron. And even in the Chinese language films, you can see this criticism in the underlying layer. Now, if you are able to read beyond the surface structure, you can find that these criticisms have been building up over the years since the year 2000, when the independent filmmakers found it so easy to make feature films using digital means. So there are young people today who are very concerned at what the future holds for them, for their children and for their grandchildren. And if they are not speaking out about this in film, in an oblique manner, because if they do it openly, they'll be asked to join political parties. That's the worst part of it. So they have to keep on making this criticism so that other citizens can, look at it and make their own decisions. Now, this is what is called as an act of citizenship. So every citizen has got the right to speak out about what is going wrong with the nation.
Have Malay films become a platform to voice a critique of the rich and powerful?
Well, in the 1950s, definitely it was there, especially from P. Ramlee. And in the 50s, many Malays migrated to Singapore, and they were, being downtrodden, and the rich Malays who had succeeded were not helping them. And you can see this in Pendekar Bujang Lapuk, where Ahmad Nisfu, who wears a British-style uniform to indicate that he has become a capitalist, just like the Westerners, only involved in profit. And then you can see in almost every one of his films, it's not just the rich, it's also the Hajis, it's also the Saids, and it's also royalty. This has been running through all his films because he himself suffered discrimination from these people who should be helping their own race. And later you can see one or two directors like M. Amin and Hussein Hanif, who also did the same thing through their narratives that P. Ramlee was doing. But as time went on, and when it came to Dato' Rahim Razali, he did make comments, but he was a bit benign. That means that it can be solved. But as we can see today, what was begun in the 1980s politically has given us all this ridiculous situation that we are facing now. So you see, there are people who cannot handle money, who cannot handle power. And these are the people who are actually bringing us to this low level.
So the question here is, what role should films play in society?
Number one, it must entertain. Nobody goes to the cinema to think. So I myself, I want to be entertained. Now, second, they have something to say, which means they are very upset at something that is happening in the world or in the country or to the people and so on. And they want to express themselves, but they do not put it right up there on the screen. They hide it. It becomes a subtext. Number three, a good film must show the culture of a country, of a people, of a community. Now, if these three elements are there, that makes for a good film. But those two people that I mentioned just now who are destroying the industry, for them it's only text, not subtext. And their text is all about making money, and they don't care whether our culture goes down the drain, whether there's no common sense in their films. So that's my take.
Do we have the capacity to produce films that make you think as opposed to just entertain?
In the last few years, we have seen a new group of filmmakers, very young filmmakers, who are really, really up there. And I can mention people like Nick Ahmed Mustafa, Namron, Tir Rahman, and so on, who are actually, if they were really given the full freedom, they can do wonderful things and bring our country's films to the next level, which is global. But you see, in about 30 over years of FINAS being around, being funded by the taxpayers' money, they have not succeeded in anything in bringing our films overseas. Except that now with Dato' Kamel Osman, who succeeded mightily at MDEC to bring our animation films overseas, perhaps he can do something because he is someone who understands film. Unfortunately, he has senior officers who, when they go to functions, do not mix with the industry or anybody outside the circle. They only stand among themselves. So how is he going to succeed if such a situation persists?
Entertainment seems to be at the heart of films today, despite how commercial filmmakers couch their motives. But then, we have an audience that also wants to be entertained.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
But what about the intellectual message behind films? Is there a market for this?
Perhaps we should take a leaf out of the Chinese language filmmakers. From the year 2010, when they made Tiger Wuhu, directed by Chiu Keng Guan, who did The Journey, almost every one of their films made money. Very few lost money as compared to the Malay films. These people are not getting funding or grants from the government. Now, how is it that they have also a very intelligent audience as compared to the Malay audience, who are still living in the 1950s. Now, what they do is they bring in Hong Kong actors to act in their films, and then they also market their films to China and Taiwan, and they also collaborate with companies from Singapore. So what they are doing is looking into the marketing. Now, this is our biggest setback. When we make a film, we are not thinking of the marketing and the distribution. I'll give an example. Here's a film called Oh La La, supposedly the first musical animation in Malaysia, which had a budget of $4 million, and a part of it was funded by the government. Now, what happened? Nobody heard of this film. And why did the panel that approved the grant did not look into a specific budget from that 4 million for the film to be marketed. I can't say that the film is really bad, no. But it is the standard of a TV drama. So a good film cannot sell itself. Only marketing and distribution sells it. So this is an area that we really must give serious attention to.
What direction is the Malaysian film industry heading?
Right now, I cannot see it heading anywhere, except for one or two people who are trying to market it overseas. Other than that, we have to wait for FINAS now under Dato' Kamel to see in which direction it's going to take, because there are certain problems that needs to be overcome, like Wajib Tayang. Wajib Tayang, they line up and their films go into the screen, whether it's good or bad. So now I think he is going to stop all this and make sure that only the good ones will get in, and so the audience has got a better selection. Otherwise, they get turned off and then finally they never go to watch the movies in the cinema and wait for it to come out in Astro First. And Astro First is also another big problem. They should just stop giving it to Astro.
End credits.
That was Hassan Mutalib, a film historian, and earlier you heard Dato' Abdul Halim Hamid, the chairperson of the Film Censorship Board. And if you're interested in Japanese cinema, on July 28th at the Contact Malaysia Pitching Centre, Hassan will be sharing his experience attending a recent Japanese cultural exchange program. For more information, look up the Japanese Foundation Kuala Lumpur on Facebook. This morning's show was produced by Cheryl Kaur, Aisyah Tajuddin, Hanif Baharuddin and myself, Azif Azuddin.
I hope this morning's show has been food for thought.
And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. This has been The Week in Review. I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisyah Tajuddin.
BFM 89.9,
The Business Station.
Back with a vengeance, back with my heart and I'm venting. Back with another war pendant, salute me and shoot me. I never wore a goofy, ignore my religion. I believe it's one God, it's one love. And I believe if I fly, we are doves. I make a way for my people to see the light, right in the yellow bones. Me and my microphone could be one, until I see big poxy pun. But this ain't easy, I can't take a big L, my city needs me. I gotta win, the proof is in the pudding. And I've been fucking with Cosby since I was 10. You damn right, any means necessary.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.